Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 10 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 19 of season 10. I've been using Boris FX products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we speak with editor Elsbeth Reynolds-Doder, ACE, and her first assistant editor, Matt Absher, about The Fall Guy. Elsbeth has been on Art of the Cut for many of her big action stunt spectaculars, including the first John Wick, Atomic Blonde, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, and Bullet Train. She's been nominated for Ace Eddies for her work on Deadpool 2 and Kate. Matt Absher has been a first assistant editor on Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, Deadpool 2, Nope, Us, Atomic Blonde, and John Wick. He was also an assistant editor on Ocean's 12 and 13. Before I hop into our discussion with Elsbeth and Matt, a brief thank you to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmark. And now, Elsbeth Reynolds-Doder, ACE, and Matt Absher discuss editing The Fall Guy. Tell me a little bit about the shot size selection for the bullhorn scene. It was one of those things that I thought of very carefully, like where you are on shots, like to see the funny like alien creature, like on the wide shot. My wife laughed at it. We both laughed at that. And then being on the close-ups at the right moment. Do you remember that scene enough to talk about it, or why you choose certain shot sizes at certain points to tell the story?
Yeah, well, I wish I was clever enough to give you an essay about it, but a lot of it is just feeling, like you try what works for you and looking at it. Like everything David and Jonathan Sella shoot, it was extremely well covered. So we had great options. I've told you this before, it's like carving out something. You just keep going. And once I have the scene assembled, I start going through every single shot for certain moments, like what's going to work best. But also with actors like Ryan and Emily, it's not hard. They are so fun to work with.
When you are cutting a scene like that and working through the process of that over a long course of time, do you feel like you need to get the structure of the scene at the beginning and then you work out performances and stuff throughout?
Especially when we're so well covered. It's very important for me to get the structure, at least vision, like where do we land, then carve our way there.
Another scene that I want to ask about before we get into some other things is the split screen scene on the phone. I just love that. It had a great sense of motion, and obviously a lot of that's some, you know, the director and the DP and the choices they're making. But talk to me about building that whole split screen scene when they're on the phone.
So a split screen scene was scripted. The day they did it, we would test it to see if it worked. And we did get some visual effect assistance in like the timing the zooms. But yeah, it was a fun scene. And we tested it out.
Yeah.
Shot, tested, shot the next one, tested it, shot the next, you know, shot.
How were they shot? Were they shot all one side first and then you had to deal with that? Or do you remember who they shot first?
Ryan, I think.
Yeah.
They shot Ryan first and then Emily, but they were both on the phone. So they weren't alone. They were both in the same space when they shot it.
I'm actually kind of surprised they did it live, because I would think that you would record one side and maybe use playback, or I guess you couldn't because you'd have multiple takes.
I don't know, but it worked.
Yeah. Oh, it worked great.
It worked really well. So I think they did the right thing, how they organized it and thought about it. And we did shorten it. So it was a question of also when to start the split screen, when would be a good moment. We could have started it the moment she called or wait for it. So that was also something we tried out, different variations of going out of it.
I love when it comes in because she does mention the split screen. She's calling him to see whether he should do the split screen, right? And then all of a sudden, then all of a sudden you're in the split screen.
But that's scripted, and it was a wonderful moment in the script as well.
One of the things that I specifically thought about the intercutting on was between the karaoke scene and then there's this garbage truck fight going on at the same time, cutting back and forth between those, and how much of that was scripted and how much was moments that you knew that you wanted to accentuate by changing when to cut intercut.
There are several intercuts in the movie. It's there. And every time we're using that intercut, except maybe in the beginning, is just not to lose the two of them because they are so amazing together. So if I would, or we would have sat in the trash bin sequence for the whole time, we would have lost Jyoti. And vice versa, if we stay in the bar without our main character, Cole, we would lose him. So it was an effort to keep them together, basically. And also amp up the excitement of it. And there are so many fun opportunities there to keep them together. But there was one shot that was supposed to happen. It's when he drives past and sees singing. That was shot specifically for that. It was tricky because we had to get to that moment, but we also had to keep the song in sync. And it's an epic song. You can't really cut it to pieces. So we had to keep that moment going long enough for the song to.
Yep. Plus you got to cheat a little bit of the geography of the run.
A little bit. This is not a documentary. Yeah. It's not a roadmap for Sydney, Australia.
Don't use it as directions.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
Just enjoy the fun of it. And we shut down that bridge. What was the name of the bridge?
The Sydney Harbour Bridge, which is the most famous bridge. Shut it down for like 6 hours, I think, which was pretty epic for the city. And it got a lot of news coverage as well. And also to the explosion in the harbor. That was an actual explosion.
That was crazy. When we saw that, we were just like, oops, they're doing that beside the Sydney Opera House.
I know.
That's another one, the Sydney Opera House. So that's a one. It's kind of funny because it's the whole scene supposedly is a oneer, but it's a big montage. Can you talk about trying to build that? And I'm sure you had so many options with stunts and the craziness and coverage all over the place of building that montage.
Great coverage. And it was so much fun to cut between Metal Storm and the Fall Guy movie. We wanted to showcase stunts. So they obviously had that. The core of the scene is how we do stunts. But at the same time, we don't want to lose that love affair between Jyoti and Colt. So that was kind of the focus, was we had the stunts. So how can we keep that love affair going through that sequence without losing our two main characters?
Is that something that as you were going through the process of the edit after the initial dailies cut that you felt like you needed to massage a little bit?
No, we were all very much aware of that from the beginning, that that had to happen.
There is a fluidity to all of it. If you watch it, there's kind of a dance vibe going on between the two of them that had to be dug out. That was not, you don't script something like that.
No.
So it wasn't just balancing the stunts and the romance.
So sweet.
No, I'm just saying that there's a fluidity to all those, the motions in those cuts.
Yeah. And that was very much something we aimed for. So, yeah.
That's one of the things that you and I have talked about before is your experience as a dancer, a dance editor. So talk to me a little bit about how your background in dance informs some of that flow that you're able to create in the edits.
For me, it's such an emotional thing. It's difficult to describe, but for me, it's extremely important that I get that feeling of the flow, that one cut leads to the other. So I use different techniques to get that. It's the movement of people. You can use a movement to have it flow into the next cut, or the eyes. So you can use those eyes to help you flow into the next. I like the flowing of cuts. That doesn't mean that sometimes you just want to cut. because we're always thinking emotion and how we can manipulate the audience into certain emotions or intrigues or, you know, keeping the story going. But in general, I like the flow until we need something else because of the story.
But to be clear, in her process that I've observed, it doesn't use a musical spine that a lot of editors sort of use, and, you know, a bit as a handicap. They sort of let a cue sort of dictate that flow. And Elspeth will cut very dry.
Thank you. Yes.
The music then has to fit. So, and adjustments can be made, but.
And it's not because I don't like music. It's
no, of course.
Because
of course.
Music is just such a powerful medium that if you cut to music, everything's going to look great with great music. So I always envision that you have to be able to watch it dry and find that music.
Hey, Matt, you've worked on several films with other editors that have been on Art of the Cut. How do you move between editors, either getting those gigs and also adapting to a new working style of a new editor?
I've been very, 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 very lucky. And I, you know, I don't know how I go from job to job, really, other than just picking up the phone at the right time. I take my profession and my career very seriously. And what that means is that no two editors are the same, and no two films are the same, and no two workflows are the same. So you have to adjust, but all the while keeping the principal idea that a cutting room is a creative space, and an assistant has to protect that. Also, you know, encourage it. And different editors need different things. There's no such thing as a perfect assistant, because each editor has their own, you know,
their own. I'm laughing because Elizabeth is pointing at you.
Yes. Yes.
As you say, there's no such thing as a perfect assistant.
There, but there isn't. There's a perfect relationship.
Yes.
There you go. A perfect relationship.
Yes, we do. We do.
Amen.
But you're only as good as your editor thinks you are. Different editors need different things, want different things. Some want a lot of security. Some don't. Some want you out of the room. Some don't. So you just have to quickly establish what preserves their creative energy so they can spend it in front of the cut. And that for some means to, I take care of all the static outside of the room, and some they want to command every decision. And you just have to figure that out quickly. But again, the base is protecting the space of the cutting room and protecting the editor.
And Matt does. And we worked together for 10 years.
Yeah, we've done
Atomic Blonde, right?
Yeah. It's been 10 years. We started working together before John Wick.
Before John Wick.
It was a pilot for HBO called The Missionary that never got picked up. But
too expensive, too much CGI.
But it was a lot of fun, and it should have gotten picked up. And
yeah.
We clicked right away. And
yeah, and he's the captain of the ship because he just runs everything. And I do consider Matt my collaborator. And we do like talking about what we're working on and doing and character and story. And
yep.
He's also my psychiatrist.
And accountant.
An accountant.
Accountant. All right. What are some of the soft skills that you've learned from her as you've worked on all these projects? There's certainly editing skills and technical skills and creative skills, but there's also dealing with the director and dealing with other people that are part of the production. What have you seen that you've learned from?
Elspeth is really fierce protector of character. And my first experience of that was on John Wick, watching her go toe to toe with two directors, you know, big martial arts guys, and staring them down on choices that she felt compelled to protect for the character. And that was really eye-opening and refreshing. And it's been like that ever since. So I could tell you stories that I can't tell about, you know, influences that she's had on projects that she really had to fight for. And it's not ego-based, or it's not some sort of power dynamic. It comes down to the characters, and not even story necessarily. It's like, would this character do this? And that's been a pleasure to watch. I have a front row seat to that.
Do you think that those arguments were successful because they sensed that it wasn't an ego thing and it was about story and character and just making the project better?
When they would sort of let her argument penetrate enough to realize that she's protecting what they were trying to create. if she's being this fierce about it and protecting their creative ideas, then she gains like immediate credibility. If they're a smart director, they see it pretty quickly.
And we've been lucky. We work with the best director that you can possibly work with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And producers.
Yeah.
Both David Leitch, Kelly McCormick.
Yeah.
You've talked to me for years about your love and appreciation for stunt people. That goes back to our earliest conversations. Tell me about your connection to that profession as an editor. And this is kind of the culmination of all of our conversations about stunt people.
Right? Hansen the Fall Guy. Well, I have to tell you, my whole career is based on stunts. I've never done any myself, but my whole career is based on stunts. Every movie I've worked with that has been a part of my journey up till now, at least for the past 12 years, have been stunt-based. We wouldn't have those movies if it wasn't for the stunt.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have John Wick or Atomic Blonde or Shang-Chi or Bullet Train or The Fall Guy. It's all based on stunts.
Just to say on a practical level, that also means communicating with that team early on and collaborating with them, which she does, which I haven't seen other editors do in the same degree of sort of intimacy. They can practice their stunts and storyboard and previs, you know, all day long, but they quickly bring what they have to Elspeth before they execute it to make sure it'll actually work. So it starts early.
Yeah, it starts early because we've built up a relationship.
Do you deal with stunt viz early on, or are you looking at it or editing with it?
Yeah, we do. We don't edit it. They
edit it.
Those guys and girls are like a mean powerhouse.
Yeah.
They just throw out stunt vizes all the time. And it's amazing. And sometimes it ends up much better than what we get. That really happens. Because when you start shooting it, you can run into all kinds of, it can be the location, it can be all kinds of stuff. It's fun working with stunts. And I love that both Kelly McCormick and David Leitch, 87 North, they are so focused on making stunts story-based. It's like a song and dance movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not like people just bursting into song and dance without any connection to the story. It's like always Bollywood. A part of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I think of as an editor myself is protecting the actors. And one of the things that I noticed on this was the beauty. You talked about that explosion in the harbor. Beautifully edited, but in the footage during the credits, you can actually see the boat does not go through very well. But in the movie, it's perfect.
Yeah, that's just movie magic. I think almost everything was practical in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
But some of it needed visual effect assistance, some of it more than others. But I mean, any stunt needs visual effects. Mm. It goes hand in hand, even if it's just removing wires and protective pads, because we don't actually hurt people. You know, it's like security of everyone participating is extremely important. I thought you said it so beautifully the other day. Stunts, it's all about the math. You have to calculate and calculated risks and all that. And then both we and post, but also very much visual effects are there just to take out the math so you don't see it.
Remove the math.
Remove the math. So the reason it looks perfect in the movie and the boat didn't land correctly is because it was a practical stunt and then visual effects came in and made it perfect. Filmmaking is such a collaborative art. And that's the biggest beauty for me. It's the collaboration of it. So all those different departments coming together to make a movie work.
Matt, can you tell me a little bit about how you prepare some of the big stunt scenes for her? Because I would think there's so many little teeny pieces, right? It's not like when you cut a dramatic scene where, oh, the scene goes on for 3 minutes and there's just six takes of that are 3 minutes long. This is tons of little pieces, right? Or no, tell me like a big scene, like one of the big stunt scenes, like in front of the Sydney Opera House. How do you even organize that for her?
I hire good people. Our team in Sydney was amazing, hugely talented team, which saved our lives every day. But to that point, the stunts are, if they're big event stunts, it's like all cameras running at once. So that's not complicated. It's the compact, tight fight sequences that have a lot of bits and pieces that have to be put together. But there's no secret to that, and there's no way I can make it any easier for Elsbeth, who just has to slog through that footage. So I wish I could give you some sort of better answer.
But I do like them in picture view, and so I can see the setups and like that.
What about the multicam stuff? Do you like to have it multicammed, or do you feel like you need to see every angle separately?
We give her both. She'll get grouped clips, and then she'll get the singles in the same bin, dropped down out of view.
But then on something like the Fall Guy, we had so much variable speed.
A ton. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know the ratio, but it was crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy ratio. Because especially because we were shooting
240. And then we have to put it all back to 24, of course, which was on us and not the lab. It was a ton of footage. I had to sort of remind Elsbeth of that. And, you know, we did 80 days of main unit. We did nearly 30 days of second unit. We did aerial. We did array days, a ton of footage. But she was not daunted by it, and it didn't slow us down in the way some other cutting rooms I've worked in were just got quickly overwhelmed. And I think that just speaks to, you know, her instincts to what's going to work and what's not. She knows it right away.
You mentioned hiring good people. So I'm assuming that organization for her is done underneath of you, or are you doing that? The actual bin organization, is that a second assistant that does that, or?
Yes and no, but yes.
But they do it because Matt has told them how I want to have it. You know,
right.
It's not like
right.
Just
right.
But we had an amazing team in Sydney.
Totally, totally. Amazing team. And I'm very non-hierarchical, and I like to just play to strengths, just whatever will get us in and out as quickly as possible. So every film is different based on who I'm working with and what they're good at. We did have one assistant dedicated only to script sync, which is often
script sync.
That is so important, especially when you have actors that all ad-lib all the time.
Right. Right.
It's just constant ad-libbing all the time.
Yeah.
It makes it's fun. It's fun to work with,
totally.
But you have to organize it and be able to find those lines.
With script sync, did you do something to be able to use it for action scenes as well? Because script sync is usually based on a script, you know, lines in a script.
It was the dialogue scenes.
Just the dialogue.
Yeah.
I've heard of people using it for other things, like literally writing out beats of action and still using script sync for that. For you, do you use script sync much during the daily portion, or is it more when you're talking to the director that you find it most valuable?
I use it mostly during the daily process, just to go through different lines, trying to find what rings best for us. But then absolutely, especially with the ad-libbing, when working with the director, and he might go, oh, I remember he said this, and then we have to find. And it's so helpful to have it script sync. So you don't have to go through 7 takes, you know, to find that line. But
yeah, and how
find
would
it
you?
Right away.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
It would make us mad.
Yeah, it's invaluable.
Matt, what are some of the other responsibilities you have once production moves on to the director's cut and beyond?
The studio is constantly folding the schedule on top of itself. So you're constantly in the moment, or you're preempting the next moment. That starts right away, all of it, all the sort of gears on this movie we're going all the time. You know, sound starts right away. You know, visual effects is grinding away, you know, on day one, music. So I'm constantly sort of managing all of those elements that keep influencing Elsbeth's cut, just as her cut keeps influencing them. So every day there's a constant flow in and out, which is great. And the more you can do it, the better, because everyone is up to date and contributing. Things shift with the director's cut, of course, after dailies, but it doesn't relent.
No, it's relentless.
Yeah.
But again, amazing crew in LA as well. We had James Liu was our visual effect editor. We had 2 music editors, Angie Rubin and Dan Pinter. We also worked closely with Dom Lewis and Dan Pinter, who was his music editor with the score, constantly sending them stuff because we would change and send them back. Michael Torres was our second.
Yep. Kyle is our second, our PA second, as it were, and amazing VFX team.
It was Matt Sloan.
Chris McClintock.
Yeah. Kate Morrison. Sean Stratton was our supervisor, and Julia Schaeffer. Amazing people. They also made it all easier than it could have
priceless.
Been. Best thing about all of us, we all love movies. And if you love movies, you love working on them. And if you love working on them, you're in a good mood. And if you're creative, you're not screaming at anyone. That's just the ground rules.
Were you always in Australia for this, or did you come back to LA? Or?
Oh, yeah, we only shot in Australia. We came back to LA for post.
You did like 7 months there. It was a long, long shoot. And then, yes, back at Los Angeles for another year.
But we got a bit delayed because of the strikes. We had both the writer's strike and actor's strike.
Are there advantages to editing on or near set?
Yes, there are. Absolutely. Without a doubt. And I think it's very important to acknowledge them. One is that you're very close to your director and producer, so it's so much easier to request things or have a dialogue. If you think something isn't working, you can go and have a dialogue about it. It's so much easier than on a phone call or like writing it down or something. Also because those people are extremely busy, so it's really handy to be able to sneak onto set. We do that a lot. We love that. But we're close. And also it's easy for the director to come and look at stuff, even though it's just to assure him everything is going well, you know. It looks amazing.
I've talked to other editors that have talked about how important it is to just reassure the director, like to be able to say, oh, I'm getting great stuff. This is so good, to be a cheerleader.
Well, I don't consider either one of us cheerleaders for David Leitch. He's just amazing. He does not need us to cheerlead anything. But it's good as a community to be there and be able to convince everyone you're doing a great job. That's really helpful. Which is why you, for example, do crew teaser. You know, when you've worked for half the movie, shooting half the movie, just give them a crew teaser to show them how amazing their stuff looks. So that's not cheerleading. It's just a part of that community you're in. And
respecting the process.
Respecting the process and respecting that people get tired and they need to see, oh, it's working. We are doing something. We are heading somewhere.
In the process of looking at the movie, once you had your editor's cut, I don't know what you like to call your editor's cut. Everybody has some different thing that they like to call it. But getting that down to the time that the movie ended, like what were some of the things that either had to go or some of the struggles of trying to get the movie to a place where you felt like the story was nimble and lean?
We were pretty happy when we showed the studio the film. But we knew it was a tad too long.
Like everybody always says, the first act is fat. Was that like one of those things where?
Yeah, which is why the intercut is there. Not only that it might have been a tad too fat, but also we intercutted him at home on the phone with Gail, with him working as a valet. And the reason for it was not only to shorten it, which was a part of it, but also for his motivation. It was kind of thought that he was a valet. He went home and got the phone call from Gail. But in order to get his motivation kind of stronger of giving up that valet job, going and how, you know, how much he missed stunts in general, was to have him drive that car when he made the decision to go.
If I remember correctly, you're hearing the conversation with Gail before you know he's a valet.
Yes. So we moved that. So C calls him. And when C says, so you're a valet, you know, and he tells her the correct name of the restaurant, that's when we cut to the valet. It used to be the other way around, that we would start with the valet and then go into the phone conversation. But this is a part where the script was right. But this is the part where you translate to a different language, which is the moving image language, it just becomes too much. So he's a valet, and then C tells you he's a valet. So like, why are we hearing it so often? So that's why we decided to condense those and cut them together. And also it got his motivation when he hears Jody, he can take off in that fancy car.
It made that decision more based on his relationship with Jody. Was there any more of Joe that relationship early? Because, like, was that a oneer at the beginning with him falling?
It's
close.
A oneer. Yeah.
They just had to switch cameras.
Yeah.
It plays as a oneer.
It plays as a oneer.
It's him.
Amazing.
It's him.
Yeah, and it's him. He's the guy who falls down. It's crazy. I think everyone was super nervous that day. That
oh, yeah, yeah.
It was the first thing. First of all, it was pretty early. Yeah.
Because it's a oneer, like, you can't really, there's no adding or subtracting, like, oh, we need a story beat to find out, you know, that, you know, how the stunt is going to go well or not.
Well, we did a lot of ADR for that scene just to draw out stuff like that. The movie star and producer standing there by the monitor, stuff like that, that we tried to help with. We used some ADR to help tell the story there. Yep. But this wonder is amazing. I think we were all speechless when we saw it. It's quite an achievement. They go from that trailer all the way to the 8th floor of the building.
And then they throw a major movie star off the ledge.
There you go.
Like, acting is enough, but then to realize I'm about to fall backwards, you know, like, oh.
He has himself told that story. That's why he needed the glasses, so we wouldn't see the fear in his eyes.
I believe it. I believe it. Oh, my gosh.
I think it's a testament to David Leitch and the crew and what the crew is willing to do for David Leitch.
How was your interaction with him and your relationship in the editing room with David? What were some of the discussions that you had? Matt was just saying how fierce you are of an advocate for character and story. Maybe that wasn't necessary on this film, but...
No, we were very supportive to each other in the editing room, I feel. I think, like I say, we just were both really happy with the director's cut that was shown to the studio, which is basically the same cut that you're watching in the cinema. It's just a lot shorter.
Your conversations that I would overhear often had to do with humor, like just executing it.
We have never disagreed, have we?
But you win those arguments, so it feels like you don't disagree with them.
Are those arguments about humor questions of switching tones?
We had a lot of discussion. Not arguments, because we don't never argue. We had a lot of discussions, and why would I argue with my director, you know?
Yep.
Would never happen, and especially not David Leitch. But we had a lot of discussions about the humor. When was it getting too much? When was it too little? Like, was it right? Just normal discussions. It was a tricky tone because it's a love story within an action extravaganza. But it's also a mystery, like a murder mystery, really. And it's two movies.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot happening. So finding that tone took us some time. David Leitch is so good with tone. I think it's also because he loves movies. Very good with tone. But it was just a bit tricky to find the line.
You mentioned that there was also a lot of improvisation with some of the actors. So that, I'm sure, played into the comedy, too, is...
Oh, absolutely. But that was so hilarious. I mean, those actors, they're ugly, but God, they're funny.
Yeah.
How do you deal with the ad-libs? Because I'm sure there's a ton of very funny stuff, and you've got to decide at what point you have to go, like, this is a riot, but it's taking away from the story, or it's slowing down the trajectory of the story.
Yeah, it was tricky sometimes, but we cried. And then we just have to move on. There's a lot of gold that ends up on the editing floor when there you have such funny, amazing crew. Hannah Whittingham, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That woman, she's a powerhouse comedian. It's kind of sad with all this ad-libbing and, you know, us trying different jokes all over. We tested the movie twice. Mm-hmm. Once in, where was it?
Sherman Oaks,
and once in Nevada. Just to try out different jokes. Like, is this funnier than this? So that's one of the way we chose the joke, because they were all good. But just to find what worked best for the jokes where they were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, different ad-libs. But we also had very, very difficult shooting in boats, in cars, with dialogue. But we have an amazing sound team as well. So Mark Stokinger has been our sound producer ever since John Wick.
Yep. And his team at
and
Formosa.
His team at Formosa. But they did an amazing job.
Yep.
Cleaning up that dialogue. So we, for example, didn't have to do any additional voice recording for the boat scene where he's talking. So they just painted out really like Jason. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Jason
Freeman.
Freeman, who was our dialogue editor. He cleaned out that freaking boat. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
We were all stunned.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Frankie and Johnny... They mixed it.
John Taylor.
John Taylor.
Yep.
And Frank Montana.
Montano.
Frankie and Johnny.
Yeah.
They mixed. They are the masters of mix. They are amazing. We mixed in the Hitchcock Theater and at Universal in Los Angeles.
A lot of this stuff is really hard to capture on set. Not just to mention all the gear that's going on, all the safety gear and the distance the crew has to be at. So there was definitely some real challenges that they...
With sound?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they were amazing.
Yeah,
they...
yes.
You mentioned the mix. What is the value of having an editor in the mix?
Because sound can change an edit. That's how simple that is. And especially when you're working with geniuses like Mark Stokinger and his team, sound can change. And it can also inspire you to change. So I feel that's a beautiful part of the process when you're sitting in the mix and listening and thinking. And but you also have to be protective of the edit because sounds can change it. You don't want too much of certain sounds that can make jump your edits.
Mm.
I remember once sitting in the mix and when Mark had like created his whole soundscape, you're just like, it's going too fast. So I had to go back and like slow it down a bit because when all those elements come together, it changes everything. It used to be with cinema photography as well. When you went into the DI, it was just like this mind-blowing experience. But now they do so much on set, DI on set.
Mm-hmm.
So the dailies you have are
yeah.
almost cinema ready,
yeah.
like almost.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're
yeah,
it's amazing. And Jonathan Stella never fails. Beautiful, beautiful cinema photographer. Yep. Love his stuff.
So no surprises in the DI.
No surprises in the DI. Except we had a surprise during... There is a world record broken in that movie
mm-hmm.
where they go 8.5 roll. And when they shot it, one of the cameras... Because this is Sydney on the beach. And one of the camera overheated. But what company was it?
A company in London called Fluent.
They fixed it.
And it's a beautiful shot. It's the car. It's a beautiful arc of this car flip. I didn't think they were going to pull it off. And it took them a few couple months, but they recreated the pixels and carved out what detail was left and were able to give it back in this pristine condition. It was really remarkable.
Well, that's pretty cool that they were able to fix it. I want to ask one last question about the sound that you were mentioning that really interests me, the effect that the sound would have on the visuals.
Yes, absolutely. I'm trying to remember what movie it was. Because when you create the whole soundscape, like when you're watching something dry, it can feel cut it down, like tighten it. Like you will keep like tightening it. But then when Mark came with his spectacular sound, I felt like, oh, we're going too fast, you know, because there's a story in that as well, like a soundscape, a good soundscape. There's story in that too. So, and that's one of the reasons I find it so important that we are given the opportunity to work together and go through both the sound, music, and DI to go all through it together.
Elsbeth and Matt, thank you so much for talking to us about Fall Guy. I really enjoyed it. I think it's going to do great.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Pleasure to meet you.
And also, I haven't seen you since, so congratulations on your Art of the Cut book. I'm going to buy it and I'm going to gift it to Matt.
Matt, a pleasure. Thank you. Elsbeth, thank you so much.
Take care. Bye.
Ciao.
Bye.
That's it for Art of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers and timeline, screenshots, and all that kind of stuff, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, you can pre-order my upcoming book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, Volume 2, for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing, featuring nearly 300 of the world's best editors. Thanks to Elsbeth Reynolds-Doder, ACE, and Matt Absher for joining us to discuss editing The Fall Guy. Thanks also to our partner, BorisFX. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @SteveHallfish.